Well, hello, and welcome to radio. Fair warning, I am grumpy today, and you need to know that, because I'm just very, very frustrated by things right now. And as you know, for the most part, I freeform this stuff. I just start talking about the things that are making me grumpy, or making me happy, or making me sad, and we see how it goes. But today, a large part of it is grumpy. I've been spending a lot of time, like a lot of people, watching this whole thing about artificial intelligence and chat and AI, and thinking that, you know, as this stuff progresses more and more, it is going to affect a lot of things. Now, I just was, as we say, made redundant at a job that I really enjoyed for the most part, writing native advertising copy and that sort of thing. And I'm not going to say that ChatGPT took my job, but I am going to say that the fellow that runs the company and the tech heads and all of the people that are involved in that sort of thing have been spending a lot of time teaching myself, because I do have a layoff period, and the other copywriters how to use this thing, how to use it to generate headlines and generate ideas and blog posts and 200, 300, 400 word kind of things. And it's kind of like, really? You know, you're teaching me how to use this thing that's going to make me not have a job in the future. And it does it in multiple languages. It's both frightening and incredible to look at. And I'm sure a lot of you have seen the articles where reporters ask this thing tough questions, and all of a sudden it gets hostile and very angry and starts, you know, basically threatening to reveal personal information and that sort of stuff. I mean, I don't know how much credence I put into those articles just yet, but yeah, we're on the verge of a brave, new, and strange world. That's making me grumpy because, you know, I work pretty hard on my written content. I work pretty hard for it to have a personality and have a point of view. And often my stuff are stories from my own life, and I like them to be real. But we're getting to the point where these machines can simulate real. And I'm not sure if it's because they're very good or if real has become so homogenized, so strip mallized, so similar that real is easy to duplicate. I mean, if you can give the thing, you know, some keywords, a data set of pickup trucks and skinny dipping and Betty Lou and beer drinking and cornfields and bonfires and cruising the back roads, if you throw in that data set, I can guarantee that it can write a song. You know what? Let's do it. Let's just do it. I'm going to see. Hold on a second. Just bear with me. Like I said, I do this off the top of my head. Okay, I'm opening a chat, and I'm going to say that, and then we'll go here. Written language, English. And then creative, human. Okay, so now what did I say? I'm going to say, write a country song based on pickup trucks, skinny dipping, whiskey, beer, cornfields. Write an upbeat country song based on pickup trucks, skinny dipping, whiskey, beer, cornfields, and bonfires. Let's see what it comes up with. So you apparently you push this little arrow here, and then you wait. And here we go. let's see. First one. Got my pickup truck, and I'm feeling fine. Gonna head on down to the river line, where the water's clear and the sun is hot. Gonna strip down to my birthday suit, and that's no lie. I've not forgot. Skinny dipping in the creek. Whiskey and beer, they're both unique. Cornfields and bonfires, now that's my scene. I'll be living my life with no time to dream. Verse 2. Got my friends with me, and they're all smiles. We're going to party like it's going out of style. The fire is a crackling and the moon is high. Gonna sip some whiskey, and that's no lie. I'm not shy. Skinny dipping in the creek. Whiskey and beer, they're both unique. Likes that line. Cornfields and bonfires, and that's my scene. I'll be living my life with no time to dream. Now here's the bridge part, you know, the little third musical part. Change the chord up a little bit here. City life, it's just too fast. But out here, time just seems to last. So I'll keep my pickup truck and my whiskey too. And keep skinny dipping in the creek with the friends I knew. Chorus again. Skinny dipping in the creek. Whiskey and beer. They're both unique. Cornfields and bonfires. Now that's my scene. I'll be living my life with no time to dream. And an outro, you know, a tag to wrap up this poetry. So if you're feeling down and your head's a spin, just take a ride out to the country within. Find a creek and go skinny dipping in, and you'll know exactly where to begin. Now, I would very much like to scoff and make fun of that, you know, computer-generated dross there, but I can guarantee you that with very few adjustments, this could be on the modern country charts in some form or another, because it's nowhere near as bad as some of the stuff. Maybe a little bit of old style Hank Williams Jr. groove. Skinny dipping in the creek, whiskey and beer, they're both unique. Cornfields and bonfires, now that's my scene. I'll be living my life, no time to dream. I'm just telling you right now, it's got legs. And I'm telling you right now, as we're recording this and you're listening to it, there are songwriters all over the world using that thing. And it just, to me, is more part of the homogenization, sterilization, everything is the sameization. And you can't tell a nickel's worth the difference between a lot of this stuff anyway, be it food, be it music, be it radio, be it anything. You can't tell, and it doesn't seem to matter. It doesn't seem to matter because it's all incredibly popular. I told you I was grumpy, and I'm also very grumpy about this. I mean, it doesn't really affect those of you that are listening to this on the actual radio, but I think this is it for me. Some of you might get confused at listening on the radio because I use this time also to make my podcast, which is called Radio, R-A-Y-D-I-O. And so sometimes I refer to that, and I'm sure it gets confusing, but you radio listeners, you know, the radio listeners, the modulated airwave folks, you're not going to have to worry about the podcast thing anymore, because I have just decided that I am not going to do the podcast part of it anymore. It just doesn't work. You know, every once in a while, as an artist or a creative person, you plant a seed and you water the seed and you try to make the seed happen, and it just doesn't grow. And I think the maximum amount of listens I've gotten to one of these programs is maybe 18. And they tend to average 5, 6, 7 on a good week. And then the last 2 weeks, it's been 3 listens. And you know, there are enough things in this world that make it hard to continue doing something. That kind of thing is just one of those things where I go, you know, I think it's interesting to listen to, and I think the stories are cool, and I think the look backs and look forwards and the whole thing, but apparently the podcasting world doesn't. I think I need to make a true crime podcast of some sort. You know, I need to retell the same true crime stories that are on about 3.7 million podcasts right now in different configurations with different people telling them, with different people reviewing the crime from this angle and that angle and that angle and that angle there and that angle over there. And then two people talk about it. Some people drink wine and laugh about it. Some people, you know, have a team of people, they get real investigators in. That's what I need to do, because those things are ridiculously popular. And I'm not going to lie, I listen to them myself. So it's obvious to me that stories about family and friends and country music and life in general just aren't podcast fodder. You know, they just aren't. So I'm going to stop putting it out there, putting the stories out there. I'll keep the stories for the people that are listening on the radio, R-A-D-I-O, and then I'll take the stories, compile them, put them together with music, and put out another book. Because, you know, that makes me feel like I've accomplished something. And a big part of this is about accomplishing something. Looking at the thing and going, you know what? It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. People just don't want to take the time to dial it up when there's a guy over there with a knife stabbing somebody. And that's something to listen to. So we'll move on from the podcast part of it. The radio part of it is going to still be here. And the recordings are going to be here. So we'll do something with them moving forward. I was actually listening back to the one I did a couple of weeks ago, maybe it was last week, about playing in country bands back in the 70s. And I realized that I didn't even scratch the surface of how much fun that stuff was back in the day. I remember I talked a little bit about the Hard Hat Tavern. And, you know, the band, we eventually did move up from those kind of places. And we moved into places in the big city, which is Baltimore for us. And we got into some of the better country and Western nightclubs in Baltimore, Club Sibyl's and the Pumpkin Patch and the Victory Lounge. You know, we got into the good places, and the Pumpkin Patch was interesting. I decided at some point, you know, I needed to branch out, find a way to get moving in more places and get out of the small town band and all that stuff. So I went up to the Pumpkin Patch one Thursday night, I think Wednesday or Thursday, because these places in the old days, they had music 5-6 nights a week. It was Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And the Wednesday, Thursday shows were pretty slow. Weekends were always big. And then Sunday was very often an all-day thing with a jamboree with three or four local country bands and food, and it was just a fun day. But this was a scene. I mean, there was a really strong, legitimate country music scene in when I grew up. And I was part of it. You know, I wanted to be part of it. And so I went to the Pumpkin Patch, which was on Waterview Avenue. And it was nicer than the Hard Hat and some of the local clubs. But it was still a country bar. And it was still a little rough around the edges. And it was attached to a motel which served truck drivers and working girls and people, you know, transient motel kind of things, which comes up later in the story, depending on how many stories about this I tell. But yeah, so I went up, and they have a tradition, you know, on the slow nights, Wednesday, Thursday, you can get up and do a couple of songs with the band. If you're a musician, you can get up and sing a little bit. And the tradition back in those days, I don't know what it is now, but the tradition back in those days, you know, is you could get up and do two or three songs at the end of the set, not the first set, because that was to the band, but second, third set, and if you did a fourth set, if you wanted to sing, you could get up and sing a song or two, but usually two or three songs, and clap, 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 you know, thanks, that was great, you know, and go away. So I went, and I kind of carefully planned this whole excursion. I wanted to get a gig there singing. Because what they had at the patch was they had a featured band, the Pumpkin Patch Pickers, God help me, and a female vocalist. She was featured. And then they had sort of a rotating, you know, lineup of guest male vocalists that came on the weekends and sang with the band. And I wanted to get into that circle because it was cool, you know, and you didn't really have to, the band would just learn your songs, or you could tell them what song you were going to do and what key, and then you guys could get up there and go for it. And that's what we did most of the time. So I went there and I sang. Now, you have to, the Pumpkin Patch Pickers were a really, really good band. They were good. I mean, these were great musicians, some of the best musicians I've ever worked with. These guys were good. And so I was also kind of nervous and excited about being on stage with musicians of this caliber. I mean, these guys could play, and they could play anything, jazz, country, really, really good musicians. Now, to say that some of them were not a brain trust. There was a song out by Bertie Higgins at the time. It was a big hit. It was called Key Largo. And it referenced the movie Key Largo. I mean, it was kind of a calypso tropical thing. Jimmy Buffett was just starting to catch on. So this sort of had that feel to it. But it referenced the movie. Of course, it was like, we had it all, just like Bogey and Bacall, sailing away something on our way to Key Largo. And of course, the next chorus starts with, here's looking at you, kid. Makes perfect sense. You know, Casablanca reference. The guy that sang that, the bass player, Little Johnny, let's call him. Little Johnny would sing that song. Great voice. Everything. Melody had no idea, no concept, no connection to the movie. Had no idea what the lyric was referencing. He would always sing it as, here's looking at your kids. Yes, here's looking at your kids. I guess she had been married before and he's talking about her kid. I have no idea. Because it made no sense. And what that man did to the lyric of Charlie Daniels, The Devil Went Down to Georgia, I can't even remember all of it, but none of it was right. None of it was right. Anyway, so I'm there. I go there, and it was like a Thursday night, Wednesday. I can't remember. And slow night. But the good thing was, as I said, I had planned this out. The boss was there. The guy that ran the place was there. His floor manager was there. The female vocalist that basically was kind of sort of in charge of everything when it came to the music, she was also there. So I picked two or three good numbers. And I, you know, again, I'm sly. I picked one that I knew that the female vocalist did as a duet with another one of the singers, and I asked her if she'd sing it with me. So the audition went well. The audition went well, and I sang my two songs, sang the duet with her, and it went well, and I hung around afterwards, and the band came over and talked to me. He said, hey, dude, you play good and you sing good, and the female vocalist came over and said, yeah, we enjoyed that. That was really good. The manager. Now, his name was George. We'll call him George. Big fella. Now, he was Greek. Most of the clubs that I would reference in those days, the Baltimore nightclub community, in one way or another, had, you know, folks that were from Greece or Greek, you know, background running them. George was Greek. His floor manager, Uncle Johnny, was very Greek. Uncle Johnny spoke very little English. And to picture Uncle Johnny, all you do is have to picture Telly Savalas in a lime green leisure suit with a parrot print shirt underneath, open to reveal plenty of gold chains and other accoutrements. And you will picture Uncle Johnny perfectly. And Uncle Johnny was hysterically funny and just the sweetest man. And we would come in when the band finally started playing the patch together as a full band. We would come in, we'd bring our gear, and Uncle Johnny would be going, Ray, you play Capitol Center or something with this stuff. We don't need this. We don't, no, it's too loud. Now, remember, we haven't started playing yet. We have not even plugged in anything, but it's too loud. It's too loud, too much. So anyway, they liked me, and George came over to me, and he goes, young man, you start next Friday, two songs with the band, every set, and I'll pay you $25. So that was the beginning of my long and somewhat storied career as a country music nightclub singer in the clubs of Baltimore, because the Pumpkin Patch began the Country Palace and then on and on and on through Club Venus and just, yeah, all of them with bands of different persuasions and always working basically for the same family or the same set of families. And yeah, $25 a night was good. When my band, The Last Chance Band, finally made it into the Country Palace as what was called a break band, they didn't want the music to stop, especially on the weekends. So Friday and Saturday, there were often two bands, main house band and then a break band. And we were often the break band because we were very popular and we would draw a sort of different audience than the older, more established acts. So it was a good combination. And when we were there, we made literally, for the whole night's work, $100. $100. And there were five of us. So, you know, we were the break band. We weren't the house band. We weren't the featured act. And so $100. And believe me, even back in the 70s, $100 was not a lot of money for playing music all night long or waiting for the other band to play while you were playing. And we would, of course, once we got to know the guys, we would sit and heckle them mercilessly while they were doing their sets. And depending on the amount of alcohol consumed by both bands, they would either accept it graciously and then heckle us, or there could be some very, shall we say, tense moments in the clubs when two bands, young boys, youngish men filled with, you know, everything that you're filled with in that age, start teasing one another and having way, way too much fun. But that was the beginnings of the Pumpkin Patch, and then up to the Country Palace and some of the other. But there was one place that we played, and it was on the same strip of Route 40, down, just down the hill from that. It was on Route 40 out that way. It was one place we played, and I cannot recall the name of it, but it was a combination country music room. Now, remember, this is like, you know, we're drifting into urban cowboy days here. So a lot of places that wouldn't typically have had country music then had it. And so we were playing at this place, and I cannot recall the name of it, but I can see it as clearly as day, because one half of it was a country and western line dance, two-step country bar, and the other half was a strip club. Now, they didn't share a community front door. There were two different doors, two different ways in, but often between the rooms on the inside, the clientele would move back and forth between the two places. And the interesting thing for the band was, you know, we're playing, we're on stage, we're playing the country hits of the day, Looking for Love in All the Wrong Places or whatever's going on. And when one of the strippers finished up their set, they would walk across the back of the nightclub to get to the locker rooms and the showers and the dressing rooms for their part of the deal. Now, I could always tell when, even though I couldn't see, because I was generally up front and the spotlights were in my eyes, so I generally couldn't see what was going on in the back of the room. I could barely see the, you know, 3 feet in front of me with those low stage lights. I could always tell when something like that had happened because the band behind me became very distracted. All of a sudden, there was no focus going on in the song that I was trying to lament my heart out to whomever was in the front there. All of a sudden, things got a little disoriented. So that meant set had finished, someone was walking across the back of the room to the dressing rooms, and someone was walking from the dressing rooms to the strip club. I remember very well my bass player and my friend Bill came over from that side. This was during the day when we were practicing or something, and he wandered over to that side. He came back, and he just kind of looked at me and said, you know, I just saw the Eagles song Tequila Sunrise interpreted in a way that I never in my mind imagined that it might be interpreted. Now, you have to remember, we're like young men at this point. We're not street smart. We're naive as hell. So a lot of this stuff was certainly eye-opening for us. So thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll see you next time around. If you enjoy it, make sure you tell whoever supplies it to you that you like it and you want to hear more. I'm Ray Weaver, and this is Radio 101.